Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Tess Vigeland. This is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 21st, 2012. Well, happy Financial Literacy Month, everyone. If you're not quite sure how to celebrate, maybe start with a little reflection.
What do I think about money? I think money is paper that just could buy you the whole wide world.
We'll visit a middle school where kids are learning to make smart money decisions. But you don't have to be in a classroom to get a finance lesson.
I usually save my money. I don't go out and spend it all, but I don't know like how to spend it, like if it's worth it or not to buy anything.
Personal finance badges for money-savvy Girl Scouts. And the national parks are free this week, so grab the kids, pack a lunch, and
any type of good, sturdy footwear, a backpack, a map, a light just in case you get caught after dark, plenty of food and plenty of water.
We've got your guide coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Food deserts. If you've listened to this show before, you've heard about them, and they've become the source of some controversy this week. They're places in the country where grocery stores and fresh food are hard to come by. Just last week, actually, Tess talked to actor Wendell Pierce about his plan to open grocery stores in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward.
We haven't had a decent grocery store in the Lower Ninth Ward in 20 years. People have to go, 45 minutes to get to a decent grocery store.
But there's some new research that says what we think about these food deserts is all wrong. The New York Times' Gina Colata recently sifted through those studies, and she's with us now. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Adrian.
So tell me, what'd you learn?
Well, I was actually really pretty surprised by this because, you know, the problem I think we all have is that you have an expectation. We've heard so much that if you go into a poor urban neighborhood, you're not going to find any place to buy fresh fruits and vegetables. And what I learned is that there were actually three studies. Two of them were national. One was California-wide, looking at poor neighborhoods and measures of obesity among children and adolescents. And all three studies came to the same conclusion, that there is no consistent relationship between the amount of between the food outlets that are available and obesity measures, and that there are not, that these poor neighborhoods are not actually food deserts. One guy called them food swamps. They have more food per person around, every kind you can imagine.
So why is the conventional wisdom wrong? I mean,
well, there's several reasons. One is I'm sure there are places that are deserts as they're normally defined. And it's easy to draw conclusions about the whole nation from one place. I was telling people, I actually live in a food desert, although I'd never thought of it. I live in Princeton, New Jersey, a small affluent town. And the only food you can get sort of walking through town is expensive candy, many places that sell ice cream, expensive bakeries. And if you want to go to a real supermarket, you have to drive 15 minutes. I mean, it's funny, you know, and people in Princeton actually are thin.
I mean, this is going to strike some people as really sort of hard to believe.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and I talked to somebody just today who said she was in New Orleans. It took her 2 hours on the bus to get to a grocery store. How do you reconcile those things?
Maybe she was in the wrong place. Maybe there wasn't anything there. But that doesn't mean that the entire nation and every poor urban neighborhood doesn't have food. And the only way to know that is to do a really rigorous study. And that's what these people did. You have to have fantastic information on every food outlet, how big it is, what it sells, how many employees. And you have to ask also over time, which these people did. They said, okay, kids have been getting fatter. If we start looking to see as the kids got fatter, were supermarkets disappearing? Were fast food places replacing them? What happened to the outlets in their neighborhood? Was there a relationship between the kids getting fatter and the composition of the food outlets? No, there was nothing there.
And so what does this mean when we talk about sort of food policy in this country and working on the obesity problem in this country? What do these studies mean for sort of that push?
It's such a difficult problem, I guess, is what it tells us. We don't know as much as we would like to know, as much as we would think we know. When I spoke to this guy, Kelly Brownell, who's from this Yale Center, which is really interested in food policy and obesity, he made an interesting point that it's not just you're not going to solve the problem by just pushing fruits and vegetable outlets into poorer neighborhoods. He suggests, getting the other kind of food out of the neighborhood. But that's obviously not all that practical. It's very difficult.
And so are we just asking the wrong questions right now as a culture when we talk about these things?
Well, I think that one of the problems is you have to ask these questions and address them and then go on and say to yourself, okay, this didn't work. So what is going on and what can we affect? It's just that the food desert thing maybe was too naive.
The New York Times, Gina Colata. Thanks.
Thank you.
Gina's article got quite a response online this week, including some heated disagreement from people involved in food policy research. We've pulled some of the stories and comments and posted them on our website, marketplace.org, for your reading pleasure. And we'd love to know what you think. Email us, tweet us, find us on Facebook. We're around.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
April is Financial Literacy Month. To some of us, financial literacy is about budgeting and saving. To others, it's about setting aside money for retirement or coming up with an investment plan. But financial literacy is also about building up community and opportunity. Next week, April 29th, is the 20th anniversary of the LA riots, 20 years since the police officers accused of beating Rodney King were acquitted, and 20 years since thousands of people protested and looted and burned blocks of LA. It's also been 20 years since the birth of Operation Hope. It's a movement designed to rejuvenate the city and educate people about finance. Khadisa Johnson runs an Operation Hope project called Banking on Our Future, which focuses on kids.
I want to see young people thrive. I want to see a young person, you know, at age 13 go and open up a bank account. And so by the time they're 20, they're in this zone and they're in this frame of mind that I can save. You know, I can look at other ways when I'm thinking about college to finance my education.
And the thing about money is that it's important. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah, because everything costs what?
Money.
Yeah, everything costs money.
These kids are in sixth grade at John Adams Middle School in Central LA. They're learning about all things money from Banking on Our Future volunteer Everett Courtney.
So it's important for us to know what to do with money, right?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Right. We don't want you to do the wrong thing with money because money is very, very important in our daily lives.
The kids are super into it. They're waving their hands with answers, scribbling notes. One of the most enthusiastic is Christopher Gonzalez. I pull him aside and ask him what he does with his money.
I save it in my piggy bank. I have my wallet and I have my piggy. On my piggy, I save it and in my wallet, I spend.
In his piggy, he's saving for college. I ask him what he thinks of people who maybe don't quite save as well as he does.
They're suckers because, like, they can't control their willpower of holding their money and they spend it all. And then later they're going to be like in the streets asking for money because they don't have no more money.
Back in the classroom, Everett is on to banks.
What is one of the main reasons why you know your money is safe in a bank? Anybody knows? Yes.
Because they have a big safe that is almost impenetrable.
Okay, great. Anybody else?
And from there, he moves right on to the FDIC.
Anybody know what those four letters stands for?
It takes a while. One of my favorite guesses, the Federal Department in California. It's got a ring to it, right? But Everett gets them there.
FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, this is a key word right here, insurance.
The kids have questions, really good questions.
Someone robs a bank and then they run off with a whole bunch of money. You still get your money back, the loss of the money?
Yeah, because the federal government insures that branch.
What if you you save and it goes over $250,000? Will the bank cover the rest or just the $250,000?
Well, right now the limit is $250,000, so anything over that, then you would be responsible for the loss. But what smart people do is that they protect themselves by starting another account.
Everett's not a teacher. He's not an accountant or an economist. Everett's an entrepreneur in South Central LA. His finance degree comes from what he calls RWU, Real World University.
I truly, truly hope that they understand the importance of earning money and doing the right thing with money and knowing how to do the right things. See, oftentimes people want to do the right things, but if they're not taught how to do the right things, they begin to emulate some of the things that they see other people do, and oftentimes it's a cycle of that ends up in poverty.
And he wants kids to understand money is about more than buying things. It's about getting someplace, moving from point A to point B, getting a degree, starting a business.
If you open up a cleaner's, if you open up a juice store, if you open up an ice cream store, if you open up a UPS store, any type of business where you're able to provide jobs, that's building a community as opposed to tearing it down.
And you can tell these kids, while they might not yet have down the intricacies of mutual funds or retirement accounts or stock portfolios, they're well on their way.
Now, what are some things that you can save money for?
College.
Good. Good.
Cars.
Great.
Bills.
Yes. Anybody want to give me one more thing else we can save money for?
For babies.
For babies? Yeah, if you don't have them, you better be saving, because I'll tell you what, they are expensive.
Everett says he keeps coming back to the classroom to drive home a simple lesson, one that he says is essential.
Everywhere we go in America, we're bombarded with material that's saying debt is good, debt is good, debt is good. I mean, on every advertisement, spend, spend, spend. And we spend till we become consumed. And everybody wants to be consumers as opposed to savers. And I think that's one of the key attributes that we need to reiterate consistently to this generation, to save for whatever it is that you want, and earn your money, start a business. Because when you start a business, not only are you creating one job, you could be creating 10 jobs, 100 jobs, or 20,000 jobs when you create a business.
This coming week on Marketplace and the Marketplace Morning Report, our Wealth and Poverty Desk takes a look at what economic mobility looks like in South Los Angeles. Mitchell Hartman reports on life in LA 20 years after the riots. Counting money from cookie sales is one thing. Budgeting for the education you need to get your dream job, that's a whole other skill.
A lawyer, principal, or a psychologist. Animal researcher of some sort, biologist, and park ranger, yeah.
Educating Girl Scouts about money, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Patty Hirsch is here with me. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Adrian.
And what do you have for us? I see you've got a stack of responses to last week's show.
Yes, indeed. We have Facebook afire and Twitter all at Twitter.
And why is everyone getting all Twitter baited?
Well, so a lot of people wrote in about our story that we had last week about women paying more for stuff.
Yeah, and that surprised me. I didn't realize how much more my gender pays.
Yeah, I didn't realize either, but I have an excuse, right? Because I'm, you know, a man.
Fair enough.
Although I am kind of mystified that my wife has never revealed this to me. I was completely confused by this disparity, but, you know.
Now, were people happy? Were they upset? What did they make of it?
A little bit of both. So we had Michael Crosser of Plymouth, Wisconsin wrote in, and he said he thought we had way too much women in the show.
Okay, overall.
Overall, yeah. He said it's what was it, Marketplace Money for Women. And he said, so many of your recent programs are wine pieces about the oppression of women. Which I thought was a little strong.
Yeah.
He wasn't the only one who talked about whining, actually. But anyway, he noted that there are more women in medical and law school than there are men these days, and that women professionals under the age of 30 make more than men. In short, he says, women have won. So congratulations.
Thank you, I think. I'm not sure.
You're in charge.
Yes, thank
Own
you.
Own it.
Phil Lanier wrote in from Spokane, Washington, to say that men tend to be less fussy than women.
Yeah, this is when it comes to many personal hygiene projects. He says, you know, more fuss means higher prices. But he is still mystified by the bathing suit question.
Which is?
Well, it's why do bathing suits cost more than the material that they have?
Oh, so the smaller the bathing suit, the more they cost?
Exactly.
I have an answer. And that is, it's a design feat. I mean, you're covering, like, you're using very small, you're covering just the essential bits with as little material as possible. And that takes, like, tremendous, like, engineering skill, I'm guessing.
It's like four pieces of string and a couple of squares of material.
You got to hang it all up. You got to get it fit right, you know?
I don't know.
We'll agree to disagree.
All right. Anyway, the final word on this women paying more issue goes to Pete Kink of Lexington, North Carolina. He wanted to know if there were any cases where men are charged more than women.
Yeah, and I've got one.
Okay.
Car insurance, because you guys are not as good drivers as we are.
Okay. Well, that's certainly my wife would agree with that one, I'm afraid to say. I'd like to actually ask listeners that if they have any other areas where men are charged more than women, I'd like to know about it. Some people have suggested a few. I'm not sure that they're true. But I'm going to hand that out to listeners and tell them to reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter and in the letters and see what they come back with.
And what else were people asking about this week?
Well, this next issue, you know, we get a lot of questions about this throughout the year. But this week we had a whole bunch of people wrote in and they wanted to know what they should do with a windfall.
So a big chunk of money. Maybe they won the lottery this last time around.
Well, maybe it was the lottery that kind of inspired that. It's possible. But yeah, so from an inheritance or an insurance payout.
A big win in Vegas. Yeah.
Okay. So you're revealing something about yourself here, Adrian. People are going to get the wrong idea. Maybe. Oh, so it's true.
I have no comment. No comment.
All right. Well, this is something I know nothing about. So I did the smart thing. Like, I called Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large of CBSMoneyWatch.com. Is she here with us?
I am here.
She's here. How are you?
Hi, Jill.
I'm fantastic.
And how's New York?
Oh, it's just beautiful.
Well, Jill, I want to get right down to it, and I want to introduce you to Santiago Crespo. He's in Houston right now. And do we have you on the line, Santiago?
Yes, you do. Hi, everybody.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So welcome to the show, and why don't you tell us what's going on with you, Santiago?
Sure. A couple months ago, my wife's grandfather passed away, and that was just a sad story. But as a result of that, we're getting an inheritance. And we're kind of wondering what to do with that money, and we've thought about two options, and one of them whether we pay down our line of credit that we have on a house that we own, or we put it towards our children's college savings.
So, Santiago, this is Jill, and I just have a couple of questions. Besides the mortgage and the line of credit, is there any other debt that's floating around in your life, some scary credit card, some student loans, an auto loan, anything else out there?
We have a very low balance on some student loans for my wife and myself.
And what's the interest rate on those student loans?
One of them is about 9%, and the second one, I believe it's 5.5%.
Just out of curiosity, the line of credit that's existing, what's the interest rate on that?
4.25%.
4.25%. Is that a variable or is that fixed?
That's a variable.
Okay. And you know, because I used to be a financial advisor, I can ask very prying questions like this. How much, you know, I have no shame. So Santiago, really, you should have changed your name. I hope you did. How much money are you guys inheriting?
Well, we're inheriting $50,000.
Okay. So you're going to watch how fast $50,000 can go away. It's going to like poof, go away before your eyes. So the 9% student loans, how much money is at 9% right now?
It's $5,000.
How much is it 5% or 5 whatever the other student loan?
It's, I think, the same amount. So it's 5,000. Over $10,000.
Okay. And the line of credit is for how much?
45.
40? Oh, ooh. That's so interesting.
Wow.
It sounds so perfect.
It really does, doesn't it? It's all adding up.
So
it almost adds up, yeah.
And Santiago, do you and your wife have an emergency reserve fund set aside, just some safe money, you know, 6-12 months of your living expenses set aside in a boring, safe place?
We don't.
Okay. So here's what I think. If you were a client of mine, I would say I have one way to help you earn a 9% guaranteed return, and that is to pay down that student loan. I would do the same thing with the 5% one. So I would just take the first $10,000 of the $50,000 and absolutely positively pay off that student loan debt.
Right.
I don't think that I would actually pay off the entire line of credit right now. I'm a little concerned that you guys are light on an emergency reserve fund. Mm-hmm. And so what I might do is I might take, say, $20,000 and pay down the line of credit. And so now you're whittling it down to $25,000. You'll keep paying it down, but you're going to pay it down a lot faster. And then I would put the remaining money in the emergency reserve fund, because then you know you have it just in case something bad happens. It's really important to have liquidity. Do you know who I've left out of this equation? Your poor children. You must think I'm a horrible person.
Goodness, what his children are going to think of him.
Do you know? I mean, really, I am just a mean person. And you know why I think that, Santiago? I mean, I'm all for saving for education. But I think that you need to make sure that these other areas of your financial life are set in stone. And I would even add one more thing in before I even started with your kids' education. I'd love to make sure that you are both putting money away for retirement to the utmost of your abilities. Because, you know, parents always hate when I give this advice. It's just really hard to put your kids behind you. But in the case of retirement, you really have to do that. It's the old story that when you get on the airplane and the flight attendant says, if something bad happens, you put that oxygen mask on yourself first, and then you take care of your kid. It's the same rule of thumb with your financial life. You secure your retirement first, because as far as I know, there are some things that you can do for education that you can't do for retirement, most notably borrow money. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does, definitely. We see it in a different view now. But we were definitely having that guilt of not putting that money towards our children, since we didn't, you know, we hadn't budgeted receiving it. So
right.
Well, guilt aside, Santiago, I mean, I would think that when you receive a lump sum like this, you might think to yourself, oh, well, this gives us a chance to splash out a little bit. I mean, Jill, where's the fun here?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Are we having fun or what? I could never have more fun than earning a 9% return, I must say. Could you take a little bit of money and spend it? Sure. What percentage of would I feel comfortable with? Is if I were the advisor, I'd say maybe 5%. You could have a little bit of fun. Go buy a flat screen and an iPad and go nuts.
Right.
And if you were talking to Santiago's kids, what would you say to them?
Sorry, kids. You know what I would say? I would say this. Isn't it better that your parents can take care of themselves in their retirement than you have to take care of them? You need your parents to be financially secure, or else it's going to be your problem. In a lot of ways, it's a great gift to your kids to be 100% financially secure.
This is the you won't thank me now, but you'll thank me later argument.
You will thank me later. They're going to be like, who's that big, tall girl from New York who screwed us on our college education?
Santiago, thanks so much for the question.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
All right. And thank you very much, Jill, for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. And thank you, listeners, for writing in with your questions. Please keep that up. You know where to find us on the Facebook and on the Twitter.
Twitter away. Also on email, you can find us online at marketplace.org.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
One bright side of the recession, and believe me, I know there aren't many, it boosted talk about financial literacy, a subject near and dear to us here. Even the Girl Scouts, best known for their cookie-selling, do-gooding ways, have created a bunch of new badges for everything from comparison shopper to good credit. Reporter Jennifer Guerra has the story.
The motto of the Girl Scouts is be prepared, especially in this post-recession economy. Just ask Girl Scout Kaylin McLean. The 16-year-old says on a scale of 1 to 10, her money management skills are right around
1. I usually save my money. I don't go out and spend it all, but I don't know how to spend it, if it's worth it or not to buy anything.
Kaylin and several of her fellow Girl Scouts are gathered at a counselor's office to talk about personal finance. Kaylin admits she hasn't thought much about money. Until now.
I think it'd be really good for me to learn about budgeting and all that different stuff that I haven't really done before, because we need to learn about it for when we go to college and we're all on our own.
The Girl Scouts' new personal finance badges are like the Brussels sprouts of awards. Not the most exciting thing at the table, but they're good for you. Kaylin and her friends, Paige Barkowiak and Jane Hodges, are on a mission to get the Financing My Future badge, which requires them to come up with a plan to pay for college. The first step towards earning the badge is to figure out your dream job.
I came up with a lawyer, principal, or a psychologist. Animal researcher of some sort, biologist, and park ranger, yeah.
My career choices were a movie director, an astronaut, and an owner of a super classy restaurant.
Now that's the fun part. The next step is, well, more like homework. The girls had to come up with a list of all the things they need to do in high school to prepare for college and go over that list with their high school guidance counselor, Christy Doyle.
Okay, so junior year, I'm looking at what you ladies have put down. And
16-year-old Paige gets right to the heart of the matter.
How much do you think the first year of college would cost, generally?
Oh, wow. That can really vary. I mean, on average, I think, you know, most colleges now are around $25,000 would be an average cost
for a year.
You can't hear it on the radio, but the look on the girls' faces when they heard that number.
$25,000.
Their eyes got huge.
She gets $5 an hour.
I asked the girls what they thought about this push to make them think about personal finance.
Yeah, I really wasn't thinking about, like, colleges and budgeting for college either until this badge.
It's your life that you're planning.
Yeah. This is going to be hard for me.
Yes.
It's like, just let's be a kid, you know, right now, but the time everyone else does it, so we got to do it too.
And while planning a budget for college and beyond isn't nearly as fun as hanging out with your friends or watching Breaking Dawn for the fifth time, it's probably a lot more fun than watching your credit score go down the drain because you weren't prepared. In Ann Arbor, I'm Jennifer Guerra for Marketplace.
I suppose those Girl Scouts could come to a decision that money just isn't worth all the fuss. Why not go without? A woman in Germany has been doing just that for years, getting by without spending a single euro. Caitlin Carroll tells us how.
Elsa Schultz opens the door to her small, vine-covered house in Heidelberg, Germany.
This is a very old house. It's Heidelberg is a very old town.
Schultz has someone staying with her at the house temporarily. We find her house guest sipping tea in the living room. She doesn't look like your typical couch surfer, more like someone's grandmother.
Hello, I'm Heidemarie Schwärmer. I live without money since nearly 16 years, and I am in the house of Else, and we are sharing things together.
For the past 16 years, Heidemarie Schwärmer has lived off the kindness of others. The 70-year-old woman house-sits, cleans, or does readings from her self-help books. In exchange, she gets a place to sleep and eat. She finds new places through word of mouth. Schwärmer says her adult children thought she was crazy when she decided to hit the road.
In the beginning, they were very sorrowful and thought, oh, our mother will go to the street. But never, I think, oh, where can I sleep?
Schwärmer developed a mistrust of money at an early age. She was born in 1942 in East Prussia, now Lithuania. Schwärmer's family left all of their wealth and came to Western Germany as war refugees.
I was a small girl, but I was thinking, how can it be that a person who has no possession has no value? We didn't change in any kind, but we hadn't any value anymore.
Schwärmer started her path toward a moneyless life in the 90s. The former teacher and psychotherapist founded Germany's first give-and-take exchange. It was a group of people who bartered with their skills instead of money.
And I began to notice, I don't need so much money anymore. And there came the idea, always I wanted to live without money.
Schwärmer's lifestyle has attracted a lot of attention. She's been featured in a documentary film and on a number of talk shows with others who are trying to live without money, too. She says some people really like the idea. Others just see her as a freeloader.
For me, they say I am taking. I am a Schnorrer in Germany.
Like a beggar.
Thomas Druyan takes a kinder view. He's a sociologist who studies the effects of money on society.
I admire these people. They prove something. But maybe it's just an art project, yeah.
He says people like Schwärmer prove that it's possible to live with less. But he thinks this way of life is more of a novelty than a template for society at large.
The solution can't be that people should get used to live without money. They should get used to live with a job, with a family, and with values.
Some people in Germany are trying to have it both ways, to have the job and home, but to also rely less on money. That's why give-and-take exchange groups are proliferating. In Frankfurt, an exchange group meets once a month at a pizza place to trade skills and stuff. Nicole Galivoda's been a member since 2004. She and her husband offer services like bike and computer repair in exchange for babysitting.
It's very useful. It's very useful for my life.
The freelance writer hasn't kept tabs on how much she saved with the exchange group, but she knows it makes a difference in her monthly bills.
Things are getting more and more expensive, so I cannot do everything without money, but if I can do a lot without paying money, that's perfect.
Heidemarie Schwärmer thinks that's the perfect balance. She knows her lifestyle isn't for everyone.
I don't say, oh, money is so bad. But I think I say money makes separation between people.
And she says if people can come together to give and take what they need, then everyone feels richer. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Budget cuts could close dozens of California state parks, but not if this woman can help it.
We're going to award you the Clara Barton Spirit Award from the American Red Cross for all your efforts to save the park. And I almost said, does that come with an $80,000 check?
The campaign to save Pio Pico State Park, coming up on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. There's only 1 week left in Financial Literacy Month, and I know the outdoors are beckoning, but a rainy day here and there might not be such a bad thing. Marketplace's Chris Farrell thinks this is a great time to get studying.
We live in a DIY money world, so financial literacy matters. It matters if you earn enough to navigate a world of 401ks, IRAs, 529 plans, and Coverdales. But it matters just as much if you don't earn much money. In many ways, it matters more. Low-income families are at great risk of falling into or being pushed into poverty. Financial literacy is all about reducing that risk. The big danger is debt. The merchants of debt are brilliant at promoting the convenience of credit and hiding its true cost. Predatory lenders thrive in poor neighborhoods. Unless consumers are financially literate, they risk falling into an endless cycle of debt repayments. The best way to become financially literate and to avoid digging yourself into debt is to ask basic questions. What's the real cost of renting furniture? What is the real interest rate that payday lenders charge? If you're in debt, financial literacy means finding ways to stop that hole from getting any deeper. Get in touch with the debt counselors at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. It's the largest and oldest of the national nonprofit credit counseling services, and there's a branch near you. Walk in or pick up the phone and ask those basic questions. Financial literacy will help you find a way out of that hole, and that means learning how to save. Start small, saving enough so that you don't have to borrow to pay the bills. Ask for help from low-cost local credit unions and community development banks. And ask for help from the government. Financial literacy means understanding what federal, state, and local government programs exist and how they work. Ask those basic questions about how to navigate Medicaid and Medicare, about how to get help paying the heating bills and other benefits. Often the first step is to admit that you're not financially literate and that you need help. There's no shame in that. Most Americans are way behind in the financial literacy stakes. It's never too late to get smart, and it's never too early to start.
Chris Farrell is the economics editor for Marketplace.
What do I think about money? I think money is that it's not an ordinary piece of paper that you can just rip up into pieces and play with. It's something valuable that you can use to trade for something.
What do I think about money? I think money is like something that you need to save it, so like in case of an emergency or something happens.
What do I think about money? I think money is paper that just could buy you the whole wide world.
It could buy you just the whole wide world. That's Daisy Alvarez with Jessica Perez and Daniel Cano. They're students at the John Adams School in Central Los Angeles and part of the Banking on Our Future program. Now, from managing money to managing time, they're pretty much the same thing. I mean, time is money, right? But a lot of folks spend hours a week working for free. They volunteer because they're passionate about a cause or a community or a place. Sometimes those few hours a week turn into a life's mission, regardless of cost. That's happened for Carolyn Schaff at Pio Pico State Historic Park. Like dozens of parks all over California, Pio Pico is threatened by budget cuts. And it's a small park, only about 4.5 acres, with an adobe home surrounded by the tiniest orange trees I've ever seen. Carolyn gave me a tour.
This is Pio Pico's historic adobe mansion that he lived in from the 1850s to the 1890s here in Whittier, California.
California is planning to close a quarter of its state parks, hoping to save millions of dollars. If the closures do happen, it'll mean fewer places for Californians and their visitors to tromp around the woods and watch the waves and maybe learn a little history. Take this park, the home of California's last Mexican governor, Pio Pico.
I call him the quintessential Californian because he represents everything we represent. He started from humble means and became very wealthy, the real California dream. He also lost everything, and I think, you know, this is a great time to be looking at that and see why people and states lose everything, you know, why we have economic problems, and maybe use it as a cautionary exercise on what we need to do differently. So, you know, it's a great history lesson that we should take and glean what we can from and not repeat it.
Carolyn is way more than a regular volunteer. She's basically taken it on as her mission to save this park, to keep it open at least one more year, to give the community time to figure out what to do.
The only way that we can keep these parks open right now is through local efforts and raising funds for the next year to keep it open, which is $80,000.
What are you doing and what is your organization doing to raise that $80,000?
Well, the Friends of Pio Pico started a campaign last month. We have a fundraising drive called Pesos for Pio Pico. We want to get the community involved. We understand that people don't have money right now, but if they can bring their recycling in, make whatever donations
they can.
So like
one can at a time.
One can at a time. Yes, one peso at a time. private donations. We have a birthday party for Pio Pico. He's going to be 211 on May 5th.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Pio Pico. And then in June is either our last hurrah or a great celebration. So it's called Fiesta de Pio Pico on June 16th, celebration or wake. And it's either going to be a celebration that we were able to raise $80,000 and keep it open for another year, or a wake to mourn the loss of such a great historic site in Southern California.
When I ask how close they are to that $80,000 goal, she laughs in a not close enough kind of way. But she says she can't even imagine these gates being locked for good.
I haven't even gone there in my head. I am just pushing forward to save this park and do whatever it takes. We've jokingly said that we're going to go camp out on the front lawn and do Occupy Pio Pico if the gates close. But I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope we can save this park. It's just an amazing treasure and an amazing asset to this community.
And you have fantasies of that phone call or that lottery ticket?
I do. I actually got an award the other day, and it was really funny. Someone called me up, and they said, I have great news for you.
And your heart
And I held my breath, and I said, let it be 80,000. And she said, we're going to award you the Clara Barton Spirit Award from the American Red Cross for all your efforts to save the park. Oh. And I almost said, does that come with an $80,000 check? But I resisted.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I was, you know, I'm very proud to get the award. But until we save the park, you know, it's kind of bittersweet.
I wander around a bit after Carolyn and I finish up, looking at the house, the long cracks that run along some of its walls, imagining Pio Pico's parties, which Carolyn tells were pretty wild. And on my way out, I run into another volunteer, Richard R. Gijo, dressed in costume. A crisp white shirt, black pants that trumpet below the knee, a blue tie around his neck, and a red sash around his waist.
This is the way they dressed in those days, you know. Everybody had their own clothing and everybody had their own colors and so forth. Back in those days, there were so many ranches that they distinguished the owner of the ranch by the color of the sash.
Richard's been volunteering here as long as Carolyn has.
This is a proud community in the Latino area. The people themselves, the history, the kids that come by wouldn't know what this was. You know, they would probably drive by, maybe condos would be here. I don't know. It depends on what they plan to do. But then there would be, like, kids who do field trips who would not have this place as a field trip. There's a lot of culture here, a lot of history that'll be lost. Well, Sundays, I wouldn't have any place to go because I try to make it a point to come here Sundays for at least 2 hours. And I just would miss seeing the kids. That's another thing. When they come by, they're all excited. They've got lots of questions. One thing, they always want to have some fruit. You know, they see the oranges that he used to use and so forth.
And can they ever get an
they
orange?
They ask me during the course of the tour, can I get an orange?
And can they ever get an orange?
When they're in full bloom, we usually, at the end of the tour, say, okay, kids, go for it. Everybody come back with an orange. And boy, they race out there to get their orange.
It's not just state parks that depend on people like Richard and Carolyn. Tight government budgets mean parks everywhere need volunteers. That includes our national parks, where this week volunteers will be out in force, keeping up with crowds of people. All of the national parks, from Yellowstone to the Grand Canyon, are free. Carrie Cobb is a ranger at Yosemite. We thought we'd grab a few minutes with her before the masses descend. Hi, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
What's the role of volunteers at the national parks?
We use volunteers for a number of different things. In the visitor center, they will talk to visitors coming in. They'll help us staff those front desks so that visitors can get more information more quickly. We have volunteers that help us revegetate closed off areas. They're really vital to the working operation of Yosemite, and they really make an impact.
It sounds like you keep them busy. No photocopying there.
Oh, we definitely keep them busy. And they're outside, which is crucial in a place like this.
And I understand this week the parks are giving back. They're free for everyone. Why do you do that?
Well, to honor National Park Week, to encourage visitors to come, to show that it's finally spring, the weather's getting great, it's a great time to visit. The national parks all across the country, including Yosemite National Park, are free for the entire week. We are planning a lot of different events, walks and talks with rangers, wildlife viewing, even information on how to make your life more sustainable and more earth-friendly.
And so do you get big crowds? I mean, is this going to be a busy week for you?
We expect it will definitely be a busy week. Anytime we do a fee-free week or weekend or day, we see more visitation come through, and we love it. We love having people come to Yosemite and see the parks for free.
Now, I guess you got to stock up on things like extra toilet paper and water and stuff, right?
We do hire on more staff, yes, and that includes the cleaning staff that will keep the bathrooms nice, but we also staff more rangers. We fully prepare for it here. We know that a lot of people come, and we want to make it as easy and as enjoyable as possible.
If somebody wants to avoid the crowds but also get in for free, what insider tips do you have for them?
Well, the best thing to do is to come early. So most of the time, when you come to Yosemite National Park, middle of the day is kind of when people start rolling in. They get up and have breakfast if they're staying out of the park, and they start coming in sometime after 10. Our busiest times at the entrance station are from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Okay.
So if you can, come in before 10 a.m. or after 2 p.m., and then once you get here, park your car. don't drive it. We have a completely free shuttle system that'll pick you up in multiple areas around the valley and take you the entire loop of the valley. You can get off where you want and you can get back on where you want. So park your car, take the bus, go see the sites, and that will definitely help with the busyness, getting in, and just making it easier.
And what kind of gear do I need to bring to really enjoy Yosemite?
For the more adventurous people, there's lots of hiking trails. So, of course, any type of good, sturdy footwear, a backpack, a map. Maps are always very helpful. A light, just in case you get caught after dark. Plenty of food and plenty of water, and you should be good to go on any of those hikes.
Does the spirit or the attitude or the energy at the parks change during National Parks Weeks at all?
You know, there's a lot of first-time visitors that come during National Park Week simply because it's free. So it's interesting. You always walk around and you can see the ones that are new because they're staring up at the granite walls, and they look a little starstruck or a little glazed over.
Just probably in awe.
Yeah, exactly. There's so much stimulation, and it's so beautiful. You can tell the new ones. So we see a lot of those stunned looks.
It sounds like a blast. If I could make it this week, I would be there with you.
Oh, well, you'll have to come at some other time. We are always here.
Carrie Cobb, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The final word on financial literacy this week comes from Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith. She got her credit card bill recently and gave the company a call looking for some answers and maybe something more.
Hello, ma'am.
Hi, how are you?
There were some false charges on your card?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. I'm going to run through the previous week of charges with you to make sure that everything is legitimate. I'll read off the charges and you just tell me yes if the charge is yours or no if it wasn't.
Okay, well, I was on vacation the week before, so there are probably some weird charges.
I'm showing a $750 charge at Hotel Tisano in Rome on March 20th.
Yes, it's a hotel in Rome. I was there for 5 days. The location was actually really amazing, and breakfast was included, so.
I'm also showing a $200 charge at Leather World on March 21st, and another $200 charge also at Leather World, also on the 21st.
Oh, wow, right. So that must sound so strange, but it's a shoe store. I mean, just like normal shoes, it's Italy, they don't understand how creepy that sounds. Not creepy, but just like, you know, some like weird sex store, which it wasn't. I mean, it was not that. It was just like a shoe store.
I'm showing a $20 charge to iTunes, also on the 21st.
Oh, right. I bought Gladiator and Eat, Pray, Love. Oh my God, you must think I have the worst taste ever. I was going to see the Colosseum, and I figured that I should just like watch Gladiator. I mean, not that I think the movie's accurate at all. I mean, I was a comparative literature major in college. I've read real books about ancient Rome. I just thought it would be fun to see like what the Colosseum might have looked like. And that's the reason I bought Eat, Pray, Love, too. I just kind of wanted to see the shots of Italy in like a fun way. I mean, I would never read that book.
A $15 charge at Titty Gelati on the 23rd.
Yes.
A $20 charge at Tootie Gelati, also on the 23rd.
God, that probably sounds like fraud, right? Because who eats $35 worth of gelato in one day? But you know, you have to try this gelato. I'm sorry, what is your name?
Alice.
Can I just like level with you, Alice? I mean, I was just in kind of a weird place. I'd always wanted to go to Italy, but I always sort of thought I would go there on my honeymoon or something. But then all of a sudden I was like, holy crap, I'm 35 and maybe I'm never going to get married. I mean, I don't want to put that weird energy out there. And I'm not one of those crazy obsessed women, but it, you know, crosses my mind because, you know, trying to date in your mid-30s, it sort of feels like everyone sees you as this ticking fertility time bomb, which I know is insane because there's so much that they can do these days. And not that I'm one of those people who wants to have babies when they're 50. But, you know, anyway, I mean, I can have kids on my own, right? I mean, it's not ideal, but it's possible.
An $80 charge at Leather World on the 24th.
Oh, right. Yes.
Okay, ma'am, those are all the charges in question. We'll be sending you an affidavit through the mail. You'll need to sign that and send it back to us. Please feel free to call us if you have any more questions.
So, Alice, where are you based? Are you near New York? I mean, maybe we could get a coffee or a gelato.
Stacy was joined by Michelle Phillippe, channeling her inner customer service rep. You can read more of Stacy's conversation. That was the edited version on theall.com, as well as our website, marketplace.org. Well, that's Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Next time, looking to land your dream job, we go backstage at Employee of the Month.
I have a dead-end job working as a business journalist, and I'm trying to find some inspiration.
I'm employed now, doing fake flower designs and dog walking. Living the dream-ish.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Special thanks this week to Millicent Jefferson, Desiree Pena, and Fiona Ng. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore, and I'm Adrienne Hill. Tess is back next week. This is APM.